Karlsson, Karlsson, världens bästa Karlsson. Karlsson, Karlsson, hoj här kommer Karlsson. Karlsson, Karlsson, ingen faktiskt ingen annan Karlsson spelar jag så bra som mig.
Karlsson, Karlsson, Karlsson scores!
Karlsson,
yeah.
Karlsson.
Welcome everybody to another episode of the Keeping Karlsson Fantasy Hockey Podcast, the best fantasy hockey podcast in the world, hosted by two guys who own Erik Karlsson in their keeper pools. I am your host, Elon Dubrovsky. It's been a bit of a layoff, but it will be worth it in your mind, I promise, because we have a really great show for you today. I was joined by Murat Atesh to talk about the Winnipeg Jets, and he brought it over an hour of solid Winnipeg Jets content going all through the lineup. I know you're going to like this interview. That's coming in just 1 second. Before we get there, I'll, of course, mention that we are presented by DopperHockey.com, the number one fantasy hockey website in the world. Great articles every day. You should really be just checking out every day if you want to be fully up to speed in fantasy, plus all the tools at Frozen Tools. I find them invaluable in prepping all of these long-form interviews. So definitely check it out, DopperHockey.com. But with that, I'm going to stop my blabbing and cut to my fantastic interview with Murat Atesh. Enjoy. Okay, everybody, really excited to bring you this next 31 Beats episode. We've got an expert to talk about the Winnipeg Jets with me from The Athletic, beat writer for the Jets, Murat Atesh. Welcome to the show, Murat.
Thanks for having me, Elon. How are you?
I'm really good. Really excited that you're here. The Winnipeg Jets are one of these teams that have really just come on so strong over the past few seasons, and I'm excited to get your takes on them and if we think that they've like peaked or if they still have more to grow, because I'll just get right into it. It's been a tough road for the Jets. Like, since they relocated from Atlanta, they only made the playoffs once in their first six seasons in Winnipeg, and the one time they did make it, they got swept by the Ducks all the way back in 2014-15 in the first round. But things have like shifted for them pretty significantly in the last three seasons. They had that huge 114-point campaign 2017-18. They end up going to the conference finals before losing to those pesky expansion Golden Knights. And then they had another strong season a couple seasons ago, 2018-19, where they finished second in the Central, but then they lost to the eventual Cup champion Blues. So they've had some tough playoff competitors. This past season, 2019-20, wasn't quite as strong as the previous two seasons standing-wise, but they were definitely in the thick of things, sitting in the first wildcard spot at the time of the pause. Though some of the nerdier hockey analysts out there, I believe yourself included, have posited that maybe the Jets were maybe a little bit lucky to be in the picture at all. They were like third last of the league in expected goals percentage. I know you've shared articles about why Connor Hellebuyck deserves the Vezina trophy because he had the highest goals saved above expectation, which is obviously great for Hellebuyck, but maybe doesn't speak so highly about the Jets. So yeah, to start off, like, I just have to get your take. Someone who's followed the team closely, do you think the Jets' record is like a fair indication of how strong the team was this season, or did the losses of like Byfuglien, Myers, Trouba, did they actually hit pretty hard and Hellebuck's play just kind of helped mask the fact that they slipped as much as they did?
Yeah, I think to be objective about the Jets, you almost have to go piece by piece of the game, because I think if you look at the roster they have and you see that they were just on the threshold of playoffs by points percentage and they're going to be in the play-ins, you might say, okay, well, that's about average. That's about kind of what we would expect based on the forwards they have that are great, the defense that they have that clearly they lost the guys that you mentioned. But I think that you start going piece by piece, and just like you said, you realize that, well, at 5-on-5, the Jets were a very poor team in terms of expected goals. They were bottom five all year long in terms of shots, shot flow, anything that you want to measure, the number of shots that Connor Hellebuyck was made to stop at 5-on-5 or their quality, any of the public stuff you can find say that he had one of the hardest jobs in the entire league. And he stopped the most goals above average and above expectation this season. I think he's a strong Vezina candidate and a strong Hart Trophy candidate if people would it look that way. I don't think he's necessarily going to be on many people's short lists, but I think there's a case for it. And then you go portion by portion. Why was the drop off at 5-on-5 so substantial? And I would say that the biggest reason that I can find for that is that the Jets peeled off a lot of their aggression. They essentially changed the way they played heading into this season to compensate for the losses of Byfuglien, Trouba, Myers, Chiarot. A lot of the guys who are extremely aggressive up ice, who could play a really aggressive game from the offensive blue line in, pinch, join the forecheck, turn the offensive zone into four forwards plus one defenseman. Those guys were gone. Winnipeg decided to go a different route and they pulled their forecheckers back and they protected their own blue line a little bit more cautiously and a little bit more conservatively. In the end, you do that with the personnel Winnipeg had on defense and you miss coverage in your own zone often enough. Well, Connor Hellebuck, like I say, had a ton of work to do. You get into special teams, the power play was average. The penalty kill was awful, and then it was great. Sort of averages out to average. The final picture is sure, their record is fine, but I think that to zoom in, and you really have to give Connor Hellebuck a huge portion of the credit. And then the team disposition-wise, in sort of withstanding the 5-on-5 barrage and still maintaining its focus in a way, because they spent so much time in their own zone. They continued to play the game plan, whether it was working or not. They did the right things. The attitude was right. All of those sorts of things kind of go into it as well, I would say.
Interesting. So yeah, they had to overcome obviously this big team change. So yeah, maybe we should give them some credit, like you say, for just kind of having the poise to hang in these games. But of course, Connor Hellebuck, such a great season. So now, like, how do you like the Jets' chances? Let's say if this play-in round actually happens, they're scheduled to play against the Calgary Flames in the play-in round. If it happens, like, let's say Connor Hellebuck is just average. Let's say he's not like stealing games for them. Do you think they have a decent chance to win that first round and to go far in the playoffs, or does this team just not have it right now?
You know, I find this one of the most difficult series to predict out of all of them. And I know that as the guy that covers the Winnipeg Jets for The Athletic, I should have a strong, like, zoomed in declarative opinion about this series. But I just see so many things that are too close to call or too difficult to project. So too difficult to project Connor Hellebuck, just like you said. What if he's just average? And the thing about goaltending, as we know mathematically, you can be one of the best goaltenders in the entire NHL. You look at a 5-game sample that play-in series would be, there's no guarantee that Connor Hellebuck's numbers, save percentage-wise, are actually above average in any random 5-game sample.
Yeah,
you sure bet on the guy because he's great. That's not a promise. That's definitely not a promise. And then on Calgary's end of things as well, some of their elite scorers and, you know, Sean Monahan, Johnny Gaudreau, and more struggled percentage-wise this year. It was tough. They had they were a better possession team than Winnipeg was. They didn't really get a lot of bang for their buck in terms of finishing things. So is that bound for some kind of regression, or is there something systemic going on in Calgary too? The one thing I'll say, Winnipeg, I would say, has the advantage in goal. The rest is tough to say. So for me, it's still a toss-up, and it's going to be a toss-up until we see it in action.
Yeah, I think it'll be an interesting series. And like you talked about Connor Hellebuck and how, like, in a 5-game sample, who knows? But Hellebuck, I feel like, has been on a bit of a roller coaster, like, since his debut with the Jets. Like, I remember we, like, lost our minds for him when he joined the team. We're a fantasy hockey podcast. So, like, he came out of nowhere when Pavlik got injured in 2015-16. And, you know, he, like, all of a sudden was, like, winning all the time, like, having these great save percentage games. It was like, oh, and who is this guy? Obviously, people knew who he was. He was a, you know, a high pedigree prospect. But it was, like, all of a sudden coming in and doing as well as he did. We were super excited going into the following season. That now, oh, the Jets have this starting goalie who's looking really good. And then he kind of had a weak second season, which then led to Winnipeg, I'm sure people recall, signing one of Brian's favorite goalies, Steve Mason, in unrestricted free agency. And he started the first game. So I guess the plan was for Mason to be the starter, but it didn't take long for Mason to get usurped by Hellebuck, who ended up having one of his best ever seasons. He had 44 wins, a sparkling .924 save percentage. But then the on-off pattern held steady. In 2018-19, Hellebuck fell a bit. Yeah, still good, but like a .913 save percentage instead of above .920. And then, as we've discussed, he was amazing again this season, back up to a .922 save percentage, 62.1 quality star percentage. So he was great this year. So now going into 2021, and I guess this playoff series, like, should we be bracing ourselves for another potential down year from Hellebuck? Or did you see anything this season to indicate that the now 27-year-old will be able to, like, break the streak and continue to be, like, one of the top goalies in the league, like, moving forward?
That's a great question. And I have to preface the answer with saying, goaltending forever will be a mystery to me in terms of projecting to it. Everybody's heard the goaltending is voodoo sort of suggestion, but Connor Hellebuck is somebody who I, like you guys, have held in extremely high regard for a long time. He was too good at too many different levels of hockey even prior to the NHL for me to write off completely at any point. After that big 2017-18 season, he was the runner-up for the Vezina Trophy. It was his coming out party. He had a huge, huge year. Outdueled Pekka in the second round of the playoffs, and then got stymied by Vegas along with everybody else in the round after that. I think that the world expected that Connor Hellebuck had arrived, and his contract that he signed that summer reflected that as well. He was getting paid like a number one guy for the first time in his career. I think, or I'm willing to believe, that there was a little bit of I arrived to Connor Hellebuck's game in 2018-2019, where the previous year, it's 2017-2018, he brought on a new movement coach in Adam Francilia, who gets a lot of praise around these parts for Hellebuck's transformation in his game. And then I think you could make a case or read into the narrative and say that there is maybe a hint of complacency to start 2018-19. And you can almost split his last season into two halves, where his start was slow. Laurent Brossoit came in like a house on fire. And there was even talk about all of a sudden, should they be a timeshare? By the end of the year, Hellebuck had picked it up. And just actually to use metrics in an attempt to guess at this, right? If you look at every goaltending season from 2017-18 to now, so three seasons for any goalie like Hellebuck that's played in all of those years, not every goalie has played all 3 years. But if you look at the entire list of hundreds of goaltending seasons since 2017-18, in terms of goals above replacement that he was able to generate, in 2017-18, he was fourth amongst all of those hundreds of seasons. In 2018-19, that step back, that average, that so-called mediocre season, he was still 33rd. He was like in the top tier overall. And so when you start to look at some of the shot quality factors, I think that there's a little bit of a redeeming streak to even his so-called bad year. And then this year, his season was ninth. So not quite as good as 2017-18, but really still amongst the absolute elites. Goaltending, I'll exit the same way I came into this question. Forever is going to be tough for me to project. I think he is a reasonably good bet to stay in the top tier for as long as his body treats him well.
Yeah, that's great to hear. I mean, you totally could have answered that question with like just a shoulder shrug and being like, I don't know, who knows? But I want to agree with you. Like he's really coming on as like one of the top goalies in the league. And it's good to hear that even in the down year, it was still like an upper echelon season in terms of all the seasons that goalies have had. Very interesting. Okay, so let's go to forwards. Maybe you could let me know if these are like easier players to project and try to figure out though. Patrick Laine, I'm going to have to say, has been a tough guy to figure out recently. Like he's also had a seesaw start to his career, kind of like Connor Hellebuck. He was looking like a sure shot superstar after his first two seasons. He pays for 40 plus goals, 70 plus points in both those years. It was even like more impressive to us because he was putting up those numbers with less than like 16 and a half minutes of ice time in 2017-18, and he was still above a 40 goal guy. So we assumed like going into year three for Laine, which was his age 20 season. It's crazy that he's played 4 years and he's only like 21, 22 right now. But yeah, going into his age 20 season, we thought he was on the verge of maybe even breaking the 50 goal mark. We wondered if maybe he was going to challenge for the Maurice Richard trophy. And it was looking like that was going to happen at first. Like if people recall, he had that amazing November where he scored 18 goals in 12 games, including that 5-goal game. And it just looked like, oh, wow, Laine is just insane. And then he like completely fell off for the rest of the season. It was so weird. He ended up with only 30 goals and 50 points overall. His shooting percentage, which had been really high, like that fell down to a more reasonable 12.2%. So then going into this season, I just recall Brian and I having no idea what to expect from Laine because it was so weird how he just disappeared last year after being so amazing for two seasons plus a couple months. But in the end, he was pretty good. This year, like it was actually really good. He had 28 goals, 63 points. That's a 34 goal and 76 point pace if he had played for the full season. So do you have an answer, Murat? Like what happened to him in that last two thirds of 2018-19 where he disappeared? And then what changed to get him back on track this past season?
Yeah, you know what? That's one of the greatest mysteries of hockey. And it continues to be, it's a difficult question to answer. And I look backwards for clues. So in his rookie season, a strange thing happened percentage-wise in that at even strength, he finished at a higher rate than he did on the power play. I think he was at something like 16% on the power play and even higher at even strength or something to that effect. But at 5-on-5, it was better than the power play. So you look at that, you kind of wrinkle your forehead a little bit. What's going on there? The second season that Laine played, his power play percentage skyrocketed and he shot almost 25% on the power play, which is just insane. And then so I look at that and I wonder why. And that was the first year that Winnipeg really leaned on its 1-3-1 with Laine as, you know, the ideal primary shooting option across the ice from Blake Wheeler. You had Mark Scheifele in the middle, who also shot in the low 20s in terms of percentages, and you had Dustin Byfuglien at the back. All three of those guys, right-handed shots, all three of them with bombs from the range they were firing them from. And it was Winnipeg's first year on that system, so maybe you might argue that they caught some teams by surprise in terms of the passing lanes Blake Wheeler was finding. I think a 1-3-1 is predictable, honestly, but the success was just because there were such good options. All three of those men were such brilliant options to shoot to. So one always had to be left open, and Winnipeg was able to exploit that. So then you get into 2018-19 where he just goes off in November. That was one of the craziest goal-scoring performances ever. He opens it with a hat-trick in Helsinki. He has a five-goal game. Everything's going his way, and then it just falls off. And I don't know. I don't have the answer for why it fell off. I can tell you he wasn't a strong possession player at any point in any of those first three seasons. So he wasn't necessarily giving himself as many looks or as many opportunities as a stronger possession player would. Still, you'd expect more than the amount of goals that he scored. This year, however, I'm willing to call this, something's going to happen in the next couple of seasons, and we're going to look at that as the breakout season. I think this is the one to point back at where he turned a bit of a mental corner for himself. In terms of his playmaking and his just distributing, he's always been an excellent passer. He found different angles and different looks. He added a slight power forward element to his game where every once in a while he was simply capable of bullying players. He's not just a shooter, let's say, and he's not just a puck carrier. Sometimes he's been playing a really intense competitive physical possession game on the wall. So he hasn't quite figured it out yet. But at 21 years old, he had just a phenomenal season and the most complete season, I would say, of his years so far in the NHL. Does he hit 50? That's the key question. I see no reason not to bet against his shooting talent. And if he plays for long enough, you have to think that one of the years he goes on a shooting percentage bender and it rolls his way and he has that opportunity. He has it in him to do that. The last thing I'll say, instead of turning this entire episode into a Patrick Laine monologue, is that what I'll always be looking for from him is sort of the selection of where is he going to score those goals from. On the power play, I sincerely believe he'll always be dangerous as long as you can get him the puck. In the zone, if he can find soft ice, he'll always be dangerous. If he continues to build up that power forward game, drive the net, he'll be dangerous. But where an Ovechkin scores 10 to 15 goals every year that Patrick Laine doesn't is by bulldozing his way right to the top of the crease and scoring goals out of havoc as well. So the more dimensions that he can add to his game, the higher that his odds of hitting that 50-goal mark go, in my mind at least.
Yeah, I mean, like we said, he's only 21. So I definitely agree with you that there's got to be at least one big breakout season coming. Though even if he stays like he did this past year, obviously it's going to be a fantastic career. I wonder if another thing that's different between him and Ovechkin so far, though, is that Ovechkin is playing on Washington's top line, you know, with Nicklas Backstrom. He's got the top center to play with. I'm sure Patrick Laine, or I'd imagine he would score some more goals if he got to play with like a Mark Scheifele all season. But it seems like he's generally been more used on the second line. Like this season, he was playing a lot with Eakin and Ehlers at the end, while Connor, Wheeler, and Scheifele were the top line. Like, do you think that there's idea in Paul Maurice's head that he wants to get Laine on the top line, or do you think he'd rather leave it how it is with Kyle Connor there? And then is that going to maybe lead to Laine not having as many opportunities as someone like Ovechkin does?
Yeah, you know what? That is well said, and it's a great question as well. I think, well, first of all, that was a big story this year. Let's be real. He was sort of taken out of context, but just before the season started, Laine did allude to the fact that, well, he hasn't played first line minutes. And some people read it as a shot against Brian Little, with whom I don't think he's ever showed a tremendous amount of chemistry with on the second line. Mm-hmm. Now, Little was hurt for most of the season, so that threw everything kind of for a bit of a loop. It was the idea of Laine wanting those top line minutes has certainly been in Jet circles for at least a year. And then if you look at the lines that Paul Maurice deploys, as a general rule, you can count on Kyle Connor, Mark Scheifele, and Blake Wheeler being the top line when things hit the fan, so to speak. There have been momentary experiments with other lines since 2017-18 when Connor broke into the league. But when the chips are down, he goes back to that combination. Now, the interesting thing with Little's injury was that it gave Paul Maurice almost an easy out in terms of giving Laine top line time. Blake Wheeler was the best remaining center option on the second line. Little was gone. They didn't have enough faith in Andrew Kopp to take that role. Jack Roslovic is still early on in his development. It became Blake Wheeler, allowing Patrick Laine to take those first line right wing minutes. And that was probably Patrick Laine's first extended look on the top line. Might not be a coincidence that he had such a transformative year in terms of his all-around game. And the more looks he gets, in transition, the more looks he gets in the offensive zone, the obviously the better the player that he's going to become. So there's a strong argument to be made, especially if you're a metrics guy and you, if you like balancing a top nine instead of going old school, that Winnipeg would do itself a favor if it spread out some of its elite scorers and gave Patrick Laine a number one line spot, gave Kyle Connor a different spot, and elevated Nick Ehlers as well. And what that means is less minutes for a guy like Blake Wheeler, which is kind of what happened this season. But does Paul Maurice envision, like when the play-ins start and everybody's healthy, does Paul Maurice, can he help himself from that Connor Scheifele Wheeler line that worked for him so well in 2017-18, the best team he's ever coached? I don't know. I think that's a tempting look for the Jets.
Yeah, and I wonder if maybe Cheveldayoff like could do Laine a favor, maybe get him a good second line center. Like Brian Little is solid, and we'll get to him in a little bit. But in general, like I saw you wrote an article recently on The Athletic. You broke down, what was it, like 16 candidates for the second line center. So I'm sure there's some are looking better than others for Patrick Laine. But I wonder if, you know, even if Paul Maurice wants to stick with the lines he does, there's still ways that he can be helped. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out over the next few seasons. But you brought up Kyle Connor. And I got to tell you, like, if you would have asked me a couple years ago who would be leading the Jets in goals for the foreseeable future, I would have assumed Patrick Laine and not thought twice about it. But Kyle Connor's outscored Patrick Laine over this past couple of seasons. He led the Jets in scoring this year. He just had a career year at 38 goals, 73 points, and only 71 games. That's a 44 goal, 84 point pace. Like an insane season for Kyle Connor. It seems like at this point, but even though we'll see from what your past answer, but like it seems like he secured, like, you know, those minutes on the top line, on the top power play. He gets a ton of ice time. He was second amongst forwards on the team in ice time behind only Scheifele. He played over 21 minutes per game. Like, we knew Connor was great. You know, he had 30 goals, 60 points over his previous two seasons, but this year, like, he really broke out as a superstar. So do you think what we saw this past season, like, was for real, and that was the real Kyle Connor? We should expect him to be this, like, 40 goal plus 80 plus point guy moving forward? And, like, if so, like, I'm just curious to know, like, what changed this year for him to break out like this?
Yeah, I think since I'm going to say partway through last season, I'm not sure exactly what month to pin it on, Kyle Connor has been leaned on in all situations in a huge way. Even in the playoffs last year, I believe against St. Louis, he was perhaps Winnipeg's minutes leader in all situations, even above Mark Scheifele for Jets forwards. He's somebody that the team simply trusts. And that includes the penalty kill. And obviously both Laine and Connor play top power play minutes as well. But at even strength, he is essentially their go-to guy. And for me, that's such an interesting thing because offensively, I think he is the real deal. There is no Jet, and that includes Laine, that includes Scheifele, Wheeler, Ehlers, all down the line. There's no single Winnipeg Jet that I would rather have the puck from about the top of the circles in than Kyle Connor.
Wow.
He's shifty on his feet. He's got a quick brain so that he never wastes opportunities in terms of reading what's in front of him and making the right call. He's a deadly finisher. He's got a great release. He simply does have, by my eyes, my observation, he's their most elite finisher from in tight by a stretch. And I think he's one of the best in the NHL. The question I have is Kyle Connor going to have as many offensive opportunities to continue this 40-plus goal pace? Because he's not a good possession player. There are things that some of the other Winnipeg Jets do, whether that's the Nick Ehlers, even a Patrick Laine to a certain extent, who I don't rate as a terrific possession player, that exceed what Kyle Connor is capable of in sort of a two-way sense. He's not a strong winger in his own zone. He doesn't have elite zone entry numbers, anything to that effect. You just get him in the offensive zone. He reads, especially he reads when Mark Scheifele and Blake Wheeler are cycling and cutting back and looking for just that perfectly timed cut from Connor into to dangerous ice for Connor to exploit that. So I think he's always going to be a high-end finisher. I think he's going to be a high-end goal scorer. Do I think he's going to be a two-way person that simply takes over games the way that a Blake Wheeler would have been at his peak? Jury's still out. He's a young player. And is still getting better and can still add that. I've had long conversations with Paul Maurice about how he believes Kyle Connor has the speed, the intelligence, and the quick stick to knock pucks down, become an elite forechecker on top of being an elite scorer. I don't see that yet. So to answer your question in a long-winded way, I think offensively very much he is what you see. He's so real in that way. And there's even, if you revamp the Winnipeg Jets power play such that he's not sort of net front and off to the side of the net and is in more of a prime shooting position should the Jets ever go away from the 1-3-1 they have right now, there's probably opportunity for Kyle Connor to score even more goals without necessarily even needing to evolve as a player. And that's a scary thought. That's a that should be a scary thought for people in the Central Division. And then it's, for me, can he become a true elite? Can he drive play? Can he do those other sorts of things? That's going to be the big mystery of, you know, as he peaks through 24 years old, 25 years old and onward.
Yeah, he's only 23. You're right. So like, he probably will even improve as a player. Plus, you're saying there's opportunities for just the play style of the Jets to give him more goals. That's wild. So, you know, I asked you before about Laine and if he's going to, you know, hit 50 goals at some point. Like, we had a question from one of our listeners, Mathieu, who would be your pick? Who's going to lead the Jets in goals over the next five seasons? Assume they play the same number of games. Who would you put your money on?
That's a great question. For me, I continue to believe that Patrick Laine has the higher ceiling. I just think that, you know, when I was talking about figuring out when he's a power forward and figuring out when he should carry the puck and figuring out when he should get into soft ice, I think that Patrick Laine has access to more than we've seen from him so far. And I think based on his dominance of Liga as a teenager, the way that he's already broken in the league, his relative age, I think he's going to find that more. And I think he's going to find those opportunities while maintaining an elite shot. So I'm more inclined to think that Kyle Connor has reached sort of his peak in terms of end of year numbers, but maybe he'll be able to replicate them a whole bunch of times. That would be a great offensive player. I think Patrick Laine, there's more in me to believe that he can find other ways to generate offense than what we've seen from him so far.
Right. I wonder what the Vegas odds would be if that line got released.
Love to see him.
I mean, Connor has had more goals for the past two seasons, so maybe Laine becomes the underdog and you can make some money. So someone's got to put that up there for us to take advantage of. Okay, so we've talked about these guys who are still at the start of their career. So I want to switch over now to someone who you've brought up who's at the other end of his career in Blake Wheeler, who's been the Jets' most consistent offensive contributor since the team moved to Manitoba. He's pretty much been a lock to hit 65-plus points year in, year out, no matter how good or bad the team was. And in fact, I recall for years, my co-host on the podcast, Brian, he would preach that Wheeler is underrated in fantasy. Like, even when he started breaking 70 points as he approached his 30s, he would still fall pretty far in fantasy drafts. And finally, someone would pull the trigger on him. And then at the end of the season, he'd be like, wow, you know who was a big surprise this year? Blake Wheeler. I couldn't believe how valuable he was to my team. But that did change a couple of years ago in that great 2017-18 season where Connor Hellebuck, you know, took off. So did Wheeler. He broke out for a huge 91-point season in his 30s. He replicated that again in 2018-19. So he cemented himself as a real superstar in the league with two straight 91 point years. Then this past season, like, Wheeler had a bit of a slow start, which caused him to land with 65 points in 71 games, falling to a 75 point pace. Though, like you've brought up, I almost don't know if we should call this like a disappointing season, because he had to deal with this fact of Brian Little's injury, and then he had to be the center on the second line. And obviously it's not as good to be playing with second liners than top liners. So like, with all this in mind, like, how would you judge this past season from Wheeler? Like, is it that he's actually just as good as he was before, and the reason for his point decrease was because of this changing role? Or, you know, did he just kind of slow down a little bit in total points because he's getting older, and that's just kind of what happens as careers progress?
Yeah, you know what? I think that Blake Wheeler, reputation-wise, will forever be cursed. This is what I think. And why I say that is because I agree with your co-host, Brian. From about 2011 onwards, I think he was one of the most criminally underrated NHL players across the league, any team, any division. If you look, I think from when Winnipeg moved from Atlanta to about 2017-18, he's, I think, in the top five, if not better, in terms of five-on-five points across the National Hockey League. And if you asked a casual fan to name their top 10 in points over that time, I don't think they'd get to him in their top 30 and then top 40. He was quietly an elite five-on-five player for almost the entirety of his career. And I don't think he got the love for that. Now you head into 2017-2018, that big that breakout season that you talk about. Now he's got that superstar status. Well, the interesting thing is how. How does he get those points? And the answer is that Winnipeg's power play exploded. Not only did the power play explode, but the entire system revolved around Blake Wheeler as the playmaker. I was talking about Patrick Laine as an elite shooter, Mark Scheifele and Dustin Byfuglien in 2017-18. That's a murderer's row of players who, because of where Wheeler is on the ice and because they're right-handed shots, every single one of them is an instant one-timing shooting option. Nobody's got to stop it and then shoot it. They're open to a one-timer. All Wheeler has to do, which isn't easy, but he's good at it, great at it even, is find the right choice, exploit the defense, choose the one that's open, fire away. Right. And if you look at his point totals, well, his even strength production stays about solid over the course of those 2 years where he hits 90-plus points, but it's on the power play where he really goes off. So now he's got superstar reputation, and I think that age is finally starting to catch up with him at 5-on-5. This particular year, his point scoring rate at 5-on-5 was the second worst of his career. Is that because of his age? Is that because he played center for a while? Probably a little bit of both. But I think it's time to start moving Blake Wheeler from one of the very best, most elite 5-on-5 players to kind of a solid first liner, maybe a really excellent, amazing second liner in terms of it 5-on-5. But the opportunity he has on the power play and a system that revolves around him on the power play has elevated him to premier level in reputation a little bit, a long time actually, after he deserved it, as far as I'm concerned.
So does he like go from being underrated all this time and now he might be a little overrated?
I think it's possible, depending on who you are. And I never know what perceptions go into whether underrated or overrated, but I personally feel like he was underrated for a solid decade. And then I think the reputation is catching up. Now he's got the all-star nods, the massive point totals as well. And because you guys are fantasy too, depending on what stats you track, it might even be great that faceoffs that he's moving into center from time to time.
Right. Because
if you've got a right winger winning you faceoffs all of the time, then all of a sudden you're making hay on that front too. So I think he continues to be a valuable player in a number of ways, even if age will catch up to him points wise.
Yeah, and hey, even if age does catch up with him, I imagine if he does get to play a whole season on the right side of Mark Scheifele, that could maybe also counteract that. And he is amazing for fantasy. He also hits, he shoots, he does it all. Multi-cat stud, a lot like Neil Pionk, who we'll get to in a little bit, who was amazing for that. But I want to do a couple more forwards with you. And I'm really fascinated by what's been going on with Nikolaj Ehlers, because we've already talked about so many offensive weapons on the team. We haven't even really gotten into Mark Scheifele. To be honest, I couldn't even really think of a good Mark Scheifele question, because he just seems to be so consistently getting the same number of points year in, year out. But Ehlers fascinates me because he's coming off a career year this past year, a lot like Kyle Connor and some of the other players we've talked about. He just put up 25 goals and 58 points in 71 games. That's a 67-point pace, a very nice bounce back from his 49-point season in 2018-19. And it's even more impressive that Ehlers just put up a 67-point pace because he doesn't get to play on the top power play like all these other guys we've talked about. He does most of his damage at even strength. It seems like Winnipeg only wants Ehlers to be on the second power play, even when they've had injuries. For some reason, Ehlers just never gets a shot on the top power play. I remember seeing guys like, you know, Matthew Perreault and just other names on the top power play ahead of Ehlers. So I guess my two questions about him are, first of all, like, which version of Ehlers would you say was the more real version of him, like the around 50-point guy from a couple years ago, or this like 65, 70-point guy this past season? And then also, I'm so curious to know, like, if he ever got that top power play opportunity, are we looking at like at a point per game guy? Because all you need is 10, 15 more power play points, which he should be able to get if he's on the top power play, and he'd be right there.
Yeah, you know what? I think he has that in him. I think he has the skill set and the ability. And because it's Winnipeg and he's tucked in reputation-wise behind Scheifele, Wheeler, Connor, and Laine, I don't know that too many people know that how good he is yet. I personally believe that what we saw from him this year is a closer reflection of his offensive ability. He led the Jets in terms of 5-on-5 points per minute, right? Like, in terms of his ice time, the amount of production that he gets out of it, he was Winnipeg's best player.
Wow.
And by eye, he was at times, four stretches, Winnipeg's best forward as well. And that's above all of those much more famous guys. The thing that he does phenomenally, and I doubt that we'll ever have, you know, zone entries as a, well, not in the immediate future in terms of a fantasy stat category, is he simply moves the puck up ice. He is one of the league's fastest skaters. He reads the defenses in front of him, and he's able to break through traps. He's able to break through forechecks and simply generate offensive zone time because he moves the puck up ice so well. He skates. He's up there with Matt Barzal and Connor McDavid as some of the most elite zone entry specialists in the NHL. So then you think about power play opportunities. Why wouldn't you want a guy like that on the top power play?
Yeah.
Who, if Mark Scheifele loses the draw and he's a below average centerman on the power play in terms of faceoff percentage, you have somebody who's almost a guaranteed zone entry coming back the other way. Well, there's a place he can make hay. He's got a plus shot. Nobody talks about his shot, but as a left-handed shooter, he actually has a solid one-timer. He can blast it. So far, the reason I would say the biggest thing that keeps him off the power play is that the Jets run a 1-3-1, and I've talked about the right-handed shooters. He's a lefty. So Wheeler in front of him has Scheifele, he has Laine, and now he doesn't have Buffalo anymore. He has Neil Pionk, a righty at the point. The only left-handed shooter on that top unit is Kyle Connor, who's limited to the net front and to the side of the net as a bit of an interchange for Blake Wheeler. There's no premier spot for a shooting left winger on that power play, and he's not going to, Winnipeg's not going to put him in Wheeler's spot to make those passes because Wheeler does it so well, and he's the captain and the franchise in a lot of ways. So if he's going to break into that top unit, he either has to take Kyle Connor's spot beside the net, and Kyle Connor is, I think, thought of by the coaching staff as, you know, the best option there, or Winnipeg's going to have to go away from its 1-3-1 and completely reinvent its power play. Now, are they going to do that? Well, they ran two top 5 years back-to-back. This year, they were average. Did they think they were average because of their system? Do they think they were average just because of chances? Do they have their own metrics in terms of the chances they're generating, et cetera, et cetera? But for Nick Ehlers, if you ever get wind of Winnipeg revamping its power play, Nick Ehlers is a great candidate because he can shoot and pass at a very high level. The league is progressively moving away from 1-3-1 power plays. What Edmonton did this year, which was incredible, what Toronto has done in terms of its puck movement, almost everybody's a shooting or passing threat. If Winnipeg goes that route, Nick Ehlers is a strong candidate, I think, to hit a career year in points whatever season that happens.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It seems like he's just a top power play opportunity away from like really jumping up in our minds, kind of like Blake Wheeler did a couple of years ago when you said that Winnipeg's power play took off. Ehlers just hasn't been able to get on the train, but maybe one day. Obviously, right now, like there's not really an obvious player for him to bump. Like it's all great players on the top power play, but if someone's injured, I'd love to at least see Ehlers get a shot there. So I brought up this article that you wrote on The Athletic before about all these potential guys who can take over as the second line center. I wanted to just talk through with you like what you think the plan is right now, because Brian Little, as we know, he missed the start of the season with a concussion, played 6 games, then he got hit in the head with the puck in his 7th game, and he ended up missing the entirety of the season, eventually undergoing surgery to repair a perforated eardrum. So actually, even before I get into anything, how is Brian Little? Like, do we think that he will be back for this playoffs, or is he feeling okay?
He's being discussed as an option and will continue to have testing throughout the summer. So we're getting right up against, I think, July 10th, assuming everything goes according to plan, is when camps are going to open. That's not that far away. Yeah. But the last that we've heard from Paul Maurice and the last that I'm aware of is that he's got ongoing testing and is a possibility to play. If he does play, I think his legacy in Winnipeg gives him an inside track at second line center. If he's capable of it, if his conditioning hits, if all of those sorts of things. He hasn't had a ton of success with between Laine and Ehlers in the past, so there's a big question mark. And then I feel like I cut you off, so I'll throw this right back to you in a second. But the thing that I'll say about Brian Little or whoever plays as Winnipeg's second line center, whether it's now or next season, is that if they slap him between Ehlers and Laine, as is the tradition in Winnipeg, they're going to get much better wingers now or in the future than Brian Little did 2 years ago, the last time he was healthy for an entire season. So they might be able to lift him up depending on where he's at.
Yeah, it's a good point. If you're playing with Laine and Ehlers, then maybe you don't have to be as elite as you used to be. But it is obvious, like, Winnipeg seems to want to go in another direction. Like, for the past 3 years, they brought in Paul Stastny, Kevin Hayes, and then this past season, Cody Eakin. Well, Cody Eakin's a whole different story because Little was injured. But, like, they've been bringing in these guys as rentals to take over as second-line center going into the playoffs. Is there a plan to, like, you know, actually get someone not just at the trade deadline, but, you know, in the off season? Like, do you think Winnipeg is going to go the free agent route or the trade route, or are they, do you think their plan for next season, say, is to lean on Little again, or do they have another player internally? Like, if you had to bet right now, I guess I keep asking you to bet. I don't even know if you're a betting guy, but like, who do you think is the second line center to start next season in terms of like a free agent, a trade acquisition, someone internally, or Brian Little?
I continue to be the, like, Charlie Brown attacks the football optimist that Brian Little will return to full health. And then the pragmatist that says for as long as he's healthy, he'll probably get the inside track at that second line job. Paul Maurice holds him in really high esteem. The organization holds him in really high esteem. And he's begun to fall off because of age, even prior to that injury. And perhaps age, and perhaps because he was being asked to carry very inexperienced non-play driving wingers at the time, like Nick Ehlers and Patrick Laine. Now Nick Ehlers, I would call him a play driver. He moves the puck up ice so well. Little wouldn't need to cover for him quite as much in the same way as in the past. And Patrick Laine has obviously improved as well. So I continue to believe that as long as he's an option, Winnipeg will give him give him that range to see what he can do with it. But then, like you said, every year there's that Kevin Hayes trade, there's that Paul Stastny trade. Like you say, Cody Eakin's probably a different story. Winnipeg is clearly aware of its need. They're going to enter, even with a flat cap, which is kind of what I anticipate. Like, there's a mechanism. The cap's not going to drop just because of the amount of revenue lost. I think there's a mechanism for the NHL and NHLPA to accept an arbitrary cap number, and it's probably going to be flat, is my best guess. All of that to say, I expect Winnipeg to have cap space this summer. It's also going to have a need at top 4D in signing Dylan DeMello and maybe even ideally one more player. But that hole at second line center continues to exist. So did they try to look at one of those 16 players I looked at? Like a Michael Granlund would be a perfect combination of play driving and high-end offensive talent. That would be a great option for them. But where are their priorities? And that's what you're asking me. I sincerely think that they'll wait and see what they have in terms of health first. They'll try a little. If he's not healthy, okay, move on. Andrew Kopp was used as a second line center very briefly at the beginning of the season. He's not a guy that'll probably ever break the charts in terms of point totals, but he's an excellent defensive center, which probably Winnipeg's best defensive center, to tell you the truth. He usually plays wing alongside Adam Lowry, so I'm not sure if everybody thinks of him as a center. That's how he was raised, and he can still do it. And he would be a perfect case of a guy who wouldn't have the offensive chops of his line mates, but would be asked to carry just a defensive load such that a line in and Ehlers or whoever's on that line can play in the right end of the ice and make hay that way. There's an option. And then Jack Roslovic, there's the other one to consider. He's played center for this, just the ever so briefest stint so far. When he does, it's almost game to game whether I believe that I'm looking at a guy who can be a second line center in the NHL, or I'm looking at a guy who's probably more of a top six winger who would benefit from having a simpler assignment. I don't think he's there. Like, I don't think he's blown down the doors and said, I'm a second line center, I'm going to definitely succeed as a center in the NHL, but he's a very good player. So whether he's on the wing in an offensive capacity in the long run or at center, I'm not sure. I think Winnipeg will exhaust every single one of these options. Then when they're exhausted, the reality is just too real that they need help. And then that's when the shopping will begin.
Yeah, and I guess if they don't get a free agent, there's lots of players they could potentially trade for, which you've listed. Like, it's a great article. People should check it out. Like Max Domi, I remember we talked about the Habs in an earlier episode, and we talked about Max Domi as someone the Habs might want to look to trade because they have too many centers. So who knows if maybe the Jets and the Habs could get on the phone and try to work something out. You brought up Roslovic. I do recall, I think it was a couple years ago, there's some buzz around this guy. Like, oh, I think this might be like a breakout season for Roslovic. He's going to get a chance in the top six, and he has had opportunities in the top six. He's never really broken out offensively yet, even playing with like Ehlers and Wheeler for a bit of the first half of this season. I see that he's a pending RFA at the end of the season. Do you think that Roslovic is someone who the Jets are going to like sign to like a long-term contract now, or do you see them giving him a bridge deal and see, like, do they know yet like who he is, or do they still need to see him play a couple more seasons before they could tell if they want to keep him long-term or not?
Yeah, you know what? I don't think that they or anyone can know exactly what Roslovic's ceiling is at this point. And I think that that maybe does inform a bridge deal for both parties. Because if you're Jack Roslovic and you're sort of like, look up Jack Roslovic's minutes, he's tucked behind so many players. Even right through last year, he was essentially a fourth line player at even strength for an extended period of time. He hasn't had a ton of opportunity until this season when he ended up with Nick Ehlers and Blake Wheeler on that makeshift second line when injuries hit. So now you're beginning to, he's getting looks, he's getting his at-bats, he's getting his repetitions, and you're beginning to see flashes of kind of the next step for him. What's he going to be? I'm not necessarily so sure at this point. So I think a bridge deal in the low $2 million sort of area probably makes a lot of sense for him to bet on himself and to believe that, hey, when I do get that opportunity, I'm going to make hay. He probably still believes, if you look back to his junior upbringing and coming up in the American system, he played at times with Matthew Tkachuk, he played at times with Austin Matthews, he outscored some of those guys at stretches. I mean, he would have been older by a little bit as well, but there's no, in my mind, trying to guess at what's in Jack Roslovic's mind, there's no part of me that believes that he has stopped thinking of himself as an elite offensive player. Give him the opportunity, he'll make hay when the time comes. So I think a bridge deal would make a lot of sense for him.
Yeah, I also feel like maybe what would make a lot of sense for him would be to go to another team, just because of all the teams that I've talked about in this series. Like, it really doesn't seem like Winnipeg has that many holes where he could jump in. Like, we've talked about, you know, Connor, Scheifele, Wheeler as the top line, and then you've got Laine and Ehlers and maybe Brian Little or someone as that center. So I guess it really is only that center spot. So I guess Roslovic is going for that. And like, normally I'm trying to speculate of like what other players can maybe jump into the top six. I don't really have many other guys to ask you about. I guess one player, I know that we've got a lot of prospect fans out there that always want to hear about the guys who haven't really had a chance in the NHL yet. And so I've got to ask about Christian Vesalainen, who was the 24th overall pick back in 2017. I'm seeing he didn't have such a great offensive season this past year, only 30 points in 60 games for the Manitoba Moose of the AHL. Obviously, I don't know the context around that and like if that's a good team or not. Did the Jets organization, do you know, did they see this past season from Vesalainen as a disappointment with him only producing at this half point per game pace? Or like, what do you think the chances are of him cracking the team and potentially making an impact next year or sometime soon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know what? He's an interesting case. He's been somebody who's been at the top of the prospect list for a little while, and maybe a season like this bumps him down a couple of notches. As you know, it wasn't really until David Gustafson went down and played a long time there, and then towards the end of the season, there was a little bit of a stronger Moose look from what I made to understand as the year went on. But as Winnipeg was hit by injuries, so too were the Manitoba Moose. And Manitoba's players like a Logan Shaw that would score a ton at the AHL level, but be more of a fill-in at the NHL level. You know, Manitoba didn't have access to that, et cetera, et cetera. What I'm doing, I think, is making excuses for Vesalainen's season. He's an interesting player. He's such an interesting player because at 18 in Liga, in terms of NHL equivalency, if you use scoring rates by league in an attempt to estimate what he would score in the NHL level, he had an astoundingly good 18-year-old season in Liga. The following year, he played for the Moose for a very short period of time. Then he went to the KHL, playing out of Finland in the KHL. He's had a lot of miles on him in a short amount of time in a very young age. And this is his first full season that just happened, his first full season on North American ice. And I know it took him some time to adapt to that and adjust to that and take different routes and sort of adjust the way that he plays. So I don't see him as ready to knock on the door and steal a Jets roster spot this fall, you know, or whenever next season actually begins, yeah. This January, whatever it's going to be, because I think he's got some work to do on the North American ice surface and at the AHL level first. In a traditional year, I would say look at this guy to be one of those half-season AHL guys, and if he's ripping the cover off the ball, so to speak, then he'd get his call-up, and that's the Jets' route, and you saw it with Jansen Harkins this year. You saw it with Mason Appleton last year. You saw it with Jack Roslovic the year before that. When Winnipeg graduates its guys, it really does its best. It wants to, and I think most organizations do. You hear Pascal Vincent, Manitoba's head coach, say this all the time. We want this to be his last call-up because he doesn't come back down. And I don't think Christian Vesalainen is ready for his last call-up at this stage. He's still young enough. I believe in him as a prospect, but I would look for that closer to a point per game AHL season, and then he'd reestablish himself as a prospect of NHL note.
Right. And I guess, hey, even Nikita Gusev, who led the KHL in scoring a couple of years ago, had trouble adjusting to the North American ice. So maybe Vesalainen just needs a little more time and we'll see what happens. But it sounds like you're saying watch his AHL numbers next year and get excited about him if and when, you know, he starts scoring at a point per game there, and then see what happens about going to the Jets. Okay, so I think we've covered the forwards pretty well. I want to end this, obviously, on D, which was like the big question mark going to the season, as we discussed at the top. Trouba was traded for Neil Pionk and a first, and then Myers left in free agency, and then there's all that drama with Dustin Byfuglien not reporting to camp. And like, the one thing I thought from all of this, because I'm dumb, is I thought the one certainty was that, okay, Josh Morrissey is someone you want to grab in fantasy now, because he's going to obviously take over as the Jets' top guy on the blue line. He was coming off a 43-point pace breakout season 2018-19, where he even got some shots on the top power play when Byfuglien was injured before Trouba took over. But like, I totally overlooked the fact that they did get someone back for in that Jacob Trouba trade, who was Neil Pionk, and Pionk took over on that top power play pretty quickly. Like, Morrissey, I don't know if people remember, he had that top power play job until mid-November, seemed to be doing pretty well, actually. He had 7 power play points through 20 games, which would work out to a 28 power play point pace season. I don't know if people generally refer to that stat, but like, that's a lot of power play points. But then Maurice decided to give Pionk a shot, and the rest was history. Pionk had a fantastic offensive season, ended up with 45 points points in 71 games. That's a 52-point pace. He had 25 power play points. Also, like I said, multi-cat stud, 177 shots, 165 hits, 78 blocks. So in fantasy, Bianco was amazing. And so I definitely want to get your thoughts on both of these guys. But let's start with Neil Pionk. Like, how good is this guy? Like, I remember when he was on the Rangers, people were talking crap about him, like saying how he was a defensive liability. He was always losing the possession battle, but he was getting big ice time. I remember at the time, I don't know, like with the Rangers, they were such a weird team. We didn't know like why he's getting all that ice time. Were they even trying to win games though? But Paul Maurice then came and gave Pionk that same amount of ice time. He was playing 23 and a half minutes per game. He was on the top power play. So like, is he actually really good? And just what we saw on the Rangers wasn't really like, you know, like that was just a bad team. And so like, he was just like not looking good because of the people he was playing with.
You know what? I'm beginning to think that has a lot to do with it, because let me wear this. I underestimated Neil Pionk. I thought that Winnipeg was getting a third pairing caliber NHL defenseman at 5-on-5 and a guy who would specialize on the power play. I liked his power play numbers in New York. I liked him at 4-on-4. I liked him anytime there was more room on the ice. I thought he could wheel, but at 5-on-5, I didn't believe in his ability to defend, and I thought he'd be a third pairing guy. I think he was Winnipeg's most important defenseman this season. Josh Morrissey was a little bit on and off. I think it's fair to say Josh Morrissey struggled. He said it himself. He learned more this season than any other in his career. And he was aware that there was criticism of his game in public circles. So all of a sudden, now Josh Morrissey is struggling. Now Dustin Byfuglien isn't playing. Neil Pionk steps forward. And at 5-on-5, he was Winnipeg's best defenseman in my mind. And on the power play, he takes that job. And you're talking about it in terms of the point production. It's so interesting to me. Because I've harped on Winnipeg's top unit being a 1-3-1 with three right-handed shooters. Josh Morrissey is a left-handed shot. I think he got that initial look on the power play as a bit of his nod to his pedigree and a bit of a nod to the fact that he was expected to be the number one guy because of he's been homegrown. He's a top pairing caliber defenseman. Struggles aside, I think everybody believes in him and probably should still believe in Josh Morrissey. So he gets that initial look and he puts up those points, like you say. But if you look at sort of the chance generation numbers, the sort of stuff that feeds into points, he wasn't necessarily as good as the defenseman on that unit would traditionally be. And I'm not saying Neil Pionk's numbers on that front were elite, but they were certainly good. And then when you go into points, I've looked this up for this. So Neil Pionk had the 12th most power play points in the NHL this season. That's incredible. A tie for 12th, I should say. In terms of power play points per 60 minutes, he was sixth in the NHL. So I think that we're not even talking about Neil Pionk on the power play in it with as much esteem as perhaps that we should be, at least as a point producer. The interesting thing about that to me is that by eye, he has put up those points in such a different way than we're used to. So he has the numbers in Winnipeg. He has the numbers in New York. I think, you know, anything can change as the time goes by, but I think we can expect he's a power play stud at this point. You'll watch him though. He doesn't have a cannon. Like out of Dustin Byfuglien, Jacob Trouba, and the various other options that Winnipeg has played on its power top unit power play over the last few years, I would say that Neil Pionk has the least hard shot of all of those. Similarly, one of the roles of the blue liner on Winnipeg's power play is to feed it across to Patrick Laine for that one-timer from time to time. Blake Wheeler is going to pass it to Neil Pionk. Neil Pionk might shoot. He might attack a lane. But one of his options is passing it over to Patrick Laine. Dustin Byfuglien's pass to Patrick Laine was a cannon. And there's a lot of belief, or at least a discussion in Jet circles, that the cannon of that pass helped Patrick Laine generate speed and beat goaltenders on the power play. Oh. Neil Pionk's is a little bit more of a soft feather. It's like a little bit more of an alley-oop sort of deal. And there's a theory, and I don't know if it's true, and I think you'd need puck and player tracking to be sure of it, that Patrick Laine has been unable to generate the speed on that shot on that one particular pass from Neil Pionk because it's not as fast as what he's used to getting. The goaltender's able to push post to post, et cetera, et cetera. All of this said, all I'm saying, I guess, is by eye, you kind of wonder how he does it. But at the end of the day, Neil Pionk was an absolutely formidable defenseman on the Winnipeg Jets power play. He's right-handed shot like the system calls for. I think the job is his to keep. And he's got the track record, even, you know, having a young career in New York where he was already putting up points. There's something to him with the man at advantage. And I would bank on that to continue unless Winnipeg ends up with just a marquee replacement of some kind.
Yeah, wow. It's just like such a wild trade because they trade Trouba, they get Pionk in that like first round pick, I think it was, which you assume like that was the big return there. But now, like, you know, Trouba, I guess he had a good defensive season this past year, but like he kind of disappeared offensively, and Pionk is the guy who's the top power play stud now. So it's interesting how things change so quickly. And it's interesting that you say it's his job to lose at this point, which I guess isn't great news for anyone banking on offense from Josh Morrissey, who like played a lot of minutes this season, but only ended up with 31 points in 65 games. It's a 39-point pace, falling from his 43-point pace the year before. You say that he admitted that he struggled a little bit and he learned a lot. So should we assume that means that Morrissey is probably going to improve moving forward? Like, do we still see Morrissey as being a 40, 45 point guy, even if Pionk holds that job on the top power play?
Well, that's the interesting question. Cause for me, point production from defensemen is so power play contingent.
Yeah.
The reason Jacob Trouba went off for 50 whatever points he did last season was the power play. He was always a strong, even strength point producer. All of a sudden, he gets the power play time, the points explode. Neil Pionk has a career year playing on the Winnipeg Jets' top power play. So can Josh Morrissey improve his numbers from this season without more power play minutes? I believe so. But I always think, or I think he's always going to be in that second tier of offensive player, in that he's a good player. He's good. He's above average at almost everything you could imagine from an NHL defenseman in terms of his speed, his mobility, his passing, his shot, everything he's pretty good at. But I don't think he's ever going to have that dominant trait that guarantees large swaths of power play prime time minutes or that sort of role. So I think we're very close to having seen Josh Morrissey's ceiling as a point producer for the Jets. Hey, he's still a number, like a top pairing caliber defenseman moving forward. I think that fans can be happy with that. But are you going to see him put up those gaudy offensive point totals that make him a power or a fantasy stud? I don't know. I'm not sure that I see it anymore, or at least without that opportunity.
Yeah, maybe his biggest fantasy contribution moving forward will be to play well defensively and help Connor Hellebuck continue to put up good fantasy numbers. And I guess aside from Morrissey, I don't really see any internal competition from players who were on the team this past season to challenge for that top power play. But the Jets do have some prospects in the system that I'd love to get your take on and see if any of them have a chance to challenge, like, first of all, to make the team and then potentially to challenge Neil Pionk, maybe to take over as the top offensive guy there. Obviously, one name that a lot of people think of is Sammy Niku, who was picked way at the end of the 2015 draft in the seventh round, but he burst onto people's radars. He had a 54-point season with Manitoba in 2017-18. And since then, Niku's gotten a couple of runs with the Jets, hasn't gotten much ice time or made any offensive impact. So maybe I'll just throw all the names at you, actually. Then you could just kind of tell me at the end here. So another name I saw is Dylan Sandberg, a 43rd overall pick in 2017. He's been with the University of Minnesota Duluth in the NCAA for the past three seasons, 21 points in 28 games this past season, which obviously I have no, like I said before, I have like no context to understand if that's good or bad. Seems good for a defenseman. I noticed with Sandberg, it's interesting because he's going to be UFA at the end of next season if he doesn't sign with the Jets. So who knows if he'll even ever play with the team. And then the one other name I wanted to run by was Ville Heinola, who was the Jets' first round pick last year, 20th overall. And he had eight games with the Jets to start the season, had 5 points, which was really good. And then he went to play the majority of the season in Finland's Liga. So yeah, any of these three guys jumping out at you as someone who is primed to make the team next year or in the next couple of years and challenge between Niku, Sandberg, and Heinola?
Yeah, you know what? Those are the guys to ask about for sure. Sammy Niku is the furthest ahead, and a lot of that's going to be age. And part of that's going to be his contract status. So with Sammy Niku, yeah, he had that massive season, 2017-18. He was a rookie in the AHL, and he won the top defenseman of the year award. Not the top rookie, not the top rookie defenseman, the top AHL defenseman on the back of his offensive ability. And the guy can wheel. He's a fast skater. He can turn on a dime. He's a great passer. He has offensive instincts. That whole game, that whole side of his game, 100% figured out. I already think of him as a dangerous defenseman at the NHL level. The problem, if you're Sammy Niku, is that you're perceived as a guy who's dangerous in his own end as well. So even this season, with so many injuries, so many absences, Dustin Byfuglien's not playing, all those UFAs depart, and there's injuries. Well, who's getting the minutes in Winnipeg? It's waiver wire acquisitions. It's depth signings. So you have Anthony Beteto, Lucas Pisa, Nathan Beaulieu, Carl Dahlstrom even. And these guys are getting minutes that Sammy Niku would otherwise, I think, have a case for. Some of that's going to be injury, but I think a lot of it is the perception that he has his own zone to figure out at the NHL level. What changes for him at the start of next season is he loses his waiver exemption. So Winnipeg could bring him to training camp, and instead of sending him to the Moose for free, like they've been able to do for so long, they've got to either keep him or risk losing him to waivers. I think based on the depth chart, and I think based on where he's at in his career, he's earned the right to be a full-time NHL defenseman and work on that part of his game to develop it in an all-round sort of status. And then fans will wonder, well, he hasn't gotten minutes so far. Does that mean that they don't think highly of him or whatever it is? And that's a question that's going to be a valid one until we see him play minutes. And I think that's just legitimate and real until we see minutes, because so many other guys have gotten it in his stead. Moving on to the other guys you mentioned, Dylan Sandberg did sign, so there's no risk of him being lost to unrestricted free agency. That was a big concern, at least in fans' eyes. I think I was under the impression for some time, and Kevin Sheveldayoff tried as hard as about a year ago, the aggression towards the contract signing began, and I think it would have been known in some circles that he was going to sign this spring, and he did eventually. All to say, he is probably the most exciting defensive prospect for Winnipeg that hasn't played in the NHL yet. He's above average at just about everything. I don't know that he's going to come in and be a massive point producer. I think that the exciting thing about him is that he projects, if everything goes well, to be able to be a top four defenseman without those holes in his game like a Nyku has, right? Like, where with Nyku, you might wonder, hey, is he always going to have this one glaring Achilles heel, whereas he can do so many offensive things brilliantly. With Dylan Sandberg, if he pans out, I think the read is that he's going to be able to handle it in his own zone and in moving the puck up ice and shooting as well. The most exciting to me, by far, long-term for sure, because he's the youngest, is Ville Heinola. And his patience with the puck, his ability to process an extremely fast game and make the right call already as an 18-year-old last fall was just superlative to me. And I don't make this comparison lightly. Amongst Winnipeg Jets that I've watched in the last few years, if you give a player not very much time and only and not very many options in terms of a pass to execute, Mark Scheifele is the best by far. He is the elite among elites. No amount of pressure will stop Mark Scheifele from making an excellent pass. Ville Heinola is maybe number two.
Wow. Like,
and that is such a small sample size that I'm leaning on to say that. And so I want to be cautious about saying he's automatically a stud because he's been able to demonstrate that at 18 years old. Like, let's be real. He's also not a big guy. He doesn't skate terribly fast. There are other parts of his game that may be an issue. But in the way that his brain processes the game, reads what's in front of him, and then executes that pass, I think that one piece of the pie is elite. Like, I think at 18, he's already shown a really special side of his game. Does he make the NHL in a full-time capacity next year? I think a lot of fans will want that, and the organization probably wants that as well. It would be an exciting turn for them. But for me, I still preach a little bit of caution because he was 18, he'll be 19. He is a smaller guy. Even his idol, Miro Heiskanen, who came in and had a massive year for Dallas, took some time to transition from Liga to full-time NHL play as well. I don't think Winnipeg can lose a ton by slow playing him, maybe running him through the AHL and looking for some really big results there first. But if there's one guy who of those three stands out to me is as having something in his game that's special, that could really mean big minutes, big numbers, big everything down the line, for me is Ville Heinola.
Cool. So yeah, anyone who's in a dynasty league, take note now, grab Heinola before it's too late, because he might come up. And, you know, like, as great as Neil Pionk has been, it seems like he should be not as entrenched as like the top power play defensive for years and years to come. Like, maybe after another great year next year, maybe he'll lock that in. But for now, like, it's still, I'm curious to know who the next guy could be. And so it sounds like you're saying it's Heinola for sure. So thanks so much for this great rundown of all these prospects and for the team in general. This has been so fun. The time has just flown by. One last question I want to ask, that we've been asking to all of our beat writers that have come on the show, is if I were to ask you to pick one Jet who you think is going to be like the biggest surprise next year in a positive way, like someone who people might not have super high on their radars and he's just going to totally exceed expectations. And then on the other end, who's a Jet who people maybe have too high on their radars and is going to end up being the biggest disappointment? Who would your two players be?
If you're going for impact on the game, I would say the guy that's not nearly famous enough for how good he is and is going to be, I'm going to say is Nick Ehlers. I think he's one of the game's premier play drivers already and has more offense to bring to the table as well. I don't think he gets he has that acclaim yet. So I think that the next step for him next year will be to gain that acclaim. And if you're looking at a guy who has the acclaim but may underwhelm, I think Kyle Connor is my lead for that. And the reason for that is just the questions I continue to have about his defensive game. And will he have enough opportunities to finish at that level that he really has demonstrated so far? I think he'd be my guess at somebody whose peak we've already seen. And Nick Ehlers would be my guess at somebody whose peak we definitely haven't.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. Like Kyle Connor just set the bar so high this past season that it would be really hard for him not to disappoint. Just staying the same would probably be like really great if he can just do that year in, year out.
Yeah, that's a good player. Like it's okay if Kyle Connor just does what he did this year.
Yeah.
I mean, defense, I continue to harp on that. And that is going to be what he needs to get better at. However, what Winnipeg has gotten out of that draft pick and out of that like that player so far, that's good. Please don't take it to mean I don't rate him as a good NHL player by any stretch. You know, Winnipeg's set in terms of young offensive talent for a lot of years.
Yeah, for sure. But I could imagine in fantasy, when you see a 23-year-old that just scored 44 goals, some people's inclination would be, oh man, the ceiling must be like closer to 50 goals. And you're saying maybe if anything, it's like Patrick Laine might still be a good person that you can get a little bit lower than what he'll end up being. So yeah, thanks again for all the time you gave us. People should definitely be reading all of your work over on The Athletic. I mentioned a couple of the articles, but it's like a really exciting list of just Jets content all the way down. You haven't stopped writing, even though the season has stopped. And it's been fun to read and follow. Obviously, people should be following you on Twitter at WPGMarat. And is there anything else you want to tell people about that they should be checking out and following?
I mean, Twitter at WPGMurat. That's the spot. And then The Athletic for Winnipeg. No, man, Elon, you've been that. That's it. You hit the spots. yeah. So thank you. The other thing that I would say is just thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Oh yeah, thank you so much for coming on the show. I was so excited when you said that you were able to come on. I see here on your Athletic profile that you appear on podcasts throughout Canada. So I'm in Toronto, so this counts, another podcast in Canada that we were so happy to have you on. Thanks so much. Have a great rest of your night and good luck to the Jets against Calgary if the series happens.
Right on. Thanks. Cheers, man.
Wow, what a fun interview. Thanks so much again to Murat Atesh for coming on the show to talk Jets with me. I really enjoyed that one. Really great insights breaking down the lineup from top to bottom. How lucky are we to be getting all of these awesome beat writers? I've got another really good one for you coming soon. I know we had a bit of a hiatus over the past week. I'm trying my best to bring you these interviews. You know, when I get the interview, I record it. And then I release it, and we're going to just try to keep it coming. We've got another one, like I said, coming really soon that you're going to enjoy. Harmon Dayal is going to be coming on soon to talk about the Vancouver Canucks. But yeah, thank you so much for listening, everybody. I hope you've still been enjoying this series. The feedback that we've gotten has been great, and I'd love to get more feedback, great or not great. Tweet at us, at Keeping Carlson. Let us know what you think. If you have any feedback, always open to hear it. If you want to help support the show, we would still, even though it is technically the NHL offseason, though now playoffs are potentially coming very soon, we'd love a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. That's a good way to help support the show. It doesn't cost you a thing. You're already on the internet, right? And then if you did want to support the show, just show us you're there by signing up as a $1 patron on Patreon for just any amount. We'll just give you all the perks that we have available, which is mainly right now our patron-only Facebook group and our monthly patron cast. We're going to be recording a patron cast very soon, actually. We got to get to scheduling that. I'm going to give Brian a call. But anyway, I will, at this point, cue the outro music, stop my rambling, and get to the credits. So this episode of the Keeping Carlson Fantasy Hockey Podcast was presented by Dauber Hockey and supported by our patrons. Logos by Brandon Weeb, outro music by Pat Roach, and this episode was researched with help from Dauber Hockey's Frozen Tools, Natural Statric, Hockey Reference, Hockey Viz, Elite Prospects, Roto-World, The Athletic, and of course, from The Athletic, Murat Atesh and all of his great insights on the Winnipeg Jets. Like I said, we should have another one of these episodes out in just a few days, so stay tuned for that, and until then, keep on keeping Carlson.